Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen, en podcast om investering og det, der foregår i hovedet, når du investerer. Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen. I dag skal vi gå i dybden med investering og det, der sker i hovedet på os, når vi investerer. Jeg har nemlig fået fat på en amerikaner, der ved en hel del om begge dele. Det betyder også, at vi skal snakke engelsk, så det vil jeg slå over i. Welcome, Drew Dixon.
Hello, Jens. How are you, sir?
I am fine. Thank you. You might not be known by all my listeners, so I have this shorter opening thing where you have to choose between two items. So that way we will get to know you. I hope you'll play along.
I will play.
Let's start it easy. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Even though you spent more than 20 years in the UK?
Yes, indeed. I never could catch on to the tea thing. I'm like Ted Lasso that way.
Oh, you didn't enjoy the tea and milk?
No, I never did. I did enjoy the pubs, but I never got to the tea part.
Great. So if you're reading something, is it fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction. Boring nonfiction. Yeah.
Boring nonfiction, yeah. So just things about companies you're investing in or new theories or where you're going?
Typically, I'm reading about, lately it's been reading books that friends of mine have written. Everyone's writing these days. So Morgan puts out a book and sells 4 million copies, Morgan Housel, and he's followed up with Same As Ever. And I've got this list of books Alex Epstein's Fossil Future, The Confidence Map from Peter Atwater, and Wanting from Luke Burgess, and a whole host of things to catch up on.
I really enjoyed Housel's Same As Ever. I thought that was quite interesting.
He's a great writer. He's very good. Don't give it away. I've got it here. He'll kill me for not having read it yet, but I still have to catch up.
Okay. So if you're relaxing, is it Netflix or exercise?
It's exercise. It's basketball. I can't show you. I can. My little basketball court I have outside the office. And that's relaxing for me. Playing my acoustic guitars is a relaxing exercise for me. Yeah, those are the two things, hoops and the guitar. Mm.
And is that the political correct answer or is that the real answer?
That's the real answer.
Oh, great.
Don't believe me. I'm not afraid to be politically incorrect. That is what it is.
Dog or cat?
Absolutely dog, yes. I've got three of them in the house.
Three of them in the house?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was the correct answer, in my opinion.
Yeah, good.
So when you are investing your own money, is it short or long-sided?
It goes both ways, PA. I mean, obviously biased to the long side. I mean, that's not obvious, I guess. But if I find things that I think are frothy or the market is over-extrapolating or getting too excited, I'll be short. But my most focus, particularly for our fund, is the long-only focused fund. So that's...
It's a long-only, yeah. Do you do day trading or only long-sided
investments? No. I don't do any day trading. It's mostly longer-term investing. But... When I say long-term, I don't mean buy and hold for 10 years of investing. I mean, basically, I want to own companies that I think the market is underreacting to changes in their business model and where I can look out a few years, 2 or 3 years, and see them severely beating earnings expectations. And when they do that, hopefully between now and then, whatever biases are preventing people from seeing what we think we see, hopefully they unwind, so you get a nice double whammy of not only fundamentals improving, but the market's perception of the company improving in the process.
We'll get back to that in a little bit, Drew. Would you call it high or low risk what you do?
I think investing in individual securities is riskier than buying diversified index funds or ETFs. So in that sense, it's high risk. But I think... depending on what kind of process you employ, you can do a lot of things to de-risk that through your research, through your fundamental research and your allocation of capital.
But don't you have a diversified portfolio in your what you're managing? I mean, don't you have more than... How many companies do you have?
And we have 22 positions in the portfolio, of which 10 of them are going to be about 60% of the fund's assets. So, I mean, that's not crazily concentrated, but it's certainly more concentrated than a 500 stock index fund.
It is. Sure, it is. And when you're investing your own money, you already answered it, but I have to go through it because I have the same questions every time I have a new guest.
Sure.
Is it stock picking or investment funds? And you said stock picking so far.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
No investment funds.
No, I've never had. We can talk later about this. I don't necessarily advocate that for every investor in the world. Most investors, the smartest thing you can do is buy a diversified, hopefully tax-efficient ETF, and buy and hold that thing and let the professionals do their work. But keeping in mind that we make mistakes, professionals are susceptible to the same biases that individuals are.
And that is exactly what we have to talk about. But now we know a little more about you. So thank you for answering my questions here.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen, en podcast om investering og det, der foregår i hovedet, når du investerer.
So what is your background? Do you have a background in finance?
Yeah, that part. I wish I were more of a polymath, but I was an undergraduate focusing on finance. I was a commodity trader doing risk management for oil companies for the first few years of my career. Then I went to business school, the University of Chicago, focused on finance, and really got into it heavily there, studying with on both sides of this sort of efficient versus behavioral debate about what drives markets. So I got Eugene Fama, Nobel Prize winner, Merton Miller, Nobel Prize winner on one side of that equation, and then Richard Thaler, also Nobel Prize winner, on the other side.
Yeah. And they were all at Chicago?
They're all Chicago. If you're just interested, we're a bit geeky, we're a bit nerdy. We don't have as much fun as they do at Harvard or Stanford. But, man, they really dive deep into the theory behind finance. And one thing Famo said then, and I still think he's right, is that it really equips you to learn finance for the rest of your life. It's not applications as much as it is theory. Why does the world work like it does? And let's question things as we go forward. And I love that aspect of it.
Mm. And you did both theoretical part of finance and also behavioral sciences with Thaler.
Yeah. With Richard Thaler, he was probably the main reason why I wanted to go to Chicago. Chicago had been known as this efficient market school with Merton Miller and with Eugene Fama. Eugene Fama coined the term efficient markets in his PhD thesis back in the 60s. And he saw this burgeoning movement in back in the mid-90s of these heretical economists starting to call into question the efficient market hypothesis and pointing out there was some some strong evidence that the market didn't always act that way. And the leading light of that movement was Richard Thaler, who at the time was up at Cornell in New York. And he, Fama, convinced Thaler to move to Chicago and join the faculty where they could have a debate. And they're vicious debates. It's wonderful watching those two battle. They're both so smart, both have high conviction in their views, but both are very open. And so I wanted to be there for that. Yeah. It was fantastic.
I saw Fama at the CFA conference one year, and the day before Kahneman was there. So that was sort of the same thing.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
And that was really, really...
Well, Kahneman was inspirational. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, they were doing great work in psychology, and Thaler, an economist, noticed this in the 80s. And he's like, oh, wow, this... Let me start doing some work with these guys. So he got very close with Danny in particular. Amos, I think, died in the early 90s. Yeah. What Richard Thaler came up with was based on work he did with Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. And, it's just, and then there's this whole group within academia, and I'm not smart enough to be an academic, but it's so fun listening to the battles and the different subsets of groups that are the efficient market guys, the behavioral guys, or... the folks kind of in between. And it's at the University of Chicago, I wanted to work internationally in equities. And I spent some time in Hong Kong with Fidelity Investments, which is a big U.S. mutual fund shop. And then went to work in the London office with them way back in 1999. And was in London for a little over 20 years. I did get to Denmark a few times, but it was only Copenhagen. I apologize. And often I have some friends in the southern part of Sweden.
Of course, yeah.
And we'd always stop in Copenhagen and spend a night before driving up to Torekov or Ballstad or where we're going. Yeah.
So you went into to finance again, back to finance, so to speak, and shouldn't you be out there making the world a better place one notch at a time if you liked Tyler that much?
Well, I think that if you can, I mean, I love our job. I love this sort of puzzle solving. And to the extent that I can help our investors be a bit more calm about their investing, a bit longer term, but also sensitive, but also just share some of my experience with people, I think it can be helpful. And a lot of the money, actually most of the money that we manage is for charitable foundations and university endowments. And so the more we can do to help them grow, the better the world is.
And that's what you're doing now. So let's talk about, you said that the professionals are biased as well.
Well, they certainly can be. We're all human beings. And I mean, I would say earlier in my career, I was I talk a lot about behavioral finance. As a stock picker, you're focused on the fundamentals of the firm. But the next level question is okay, why doesn't the market see the way things, or at least the way you think things are?
Yeah.
And that's when you start to try to uncover biases the market may have. And that's all I kind of did earlier in my career. But as I grew up a bit and spent more time, I started to realize that this, it's equally, if not more important, to focus on your own stuff. What biases do you have? What is preventing you from, you know, you're trying to capitalize on all these mistakes that Mr. Market's making, but are you making some? Are you anchoring to your old views? Are you looking for confirming information? And so, I absolutely think that professional asset managers are prone to biases. Those that pretend otherwise, I think that's an issue. And I think those that are constantly battling them, that's what we should be doing.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen med Jens Bale.
But isn't it very hard to see your own biases? I mean, Kahneman he said that he's shocked how little his knowledge of biases has helped him during good decisions.
Yeah. No, he's absolutely right. And he wrote in, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow that, you know, he came up with many of these biases. He discovered them and yet he still suffers from them himself.
Yeah.
And so the question as a professional money manager, knowing that, I mean, even Danny Kahneman suffers from these things. How on earth am I going to prevent them from happening to me? So first of all, you realize that you can't. A. B, you try to set up a process, like at least in my firm, based on this philosophy that there are certain specific types of behavioral things that we might do. Some of it's not necessarily behavioral. Some is just career-based, or trying to protect your position in a firm or your impression of you and all these things that can enter the mix. But the true behavioral stuff, if you have a process and a philosophy that allows you to identify what those mistakes are that you might be making, and having a culture where it's okay to do that, where it's okay to make mistakes, I think that helps to solve some of the problem. And moreover, the partners that you have, the people that you're managing money for, if they've done a lot of work understanding your process and that philosophy, well, it's easier for you to make mistakes with them as investors. Because certainly as a young analyst, and I'm sure even now, the last thing you want to do is give people bad news. The last thing you do is, oh, we lost money on this, or you do a lot of work on a company and you have high conviction that you're right and you end up being wrong. Well, at the end of the day, Jens, if you're a very good stock picker, you're going to get 2 out of 3 of your positions correct. That's really good. That's well above.
That's very good, yeah.
And that means if you're that good, that you're going to get 1 out of 3 wrong. And in my view, and this is sort of flipping things a bit, I think you should be trying to get 1 out of 3 wrong.
Yeah. What does that give you?
Well, when you do that, then as you work your way through your portfolio, and I mentioned in our case, we'll have 20 or 25 securities. But if that's true, I can look at them. And if we're going to get 65% correct, then 6 or 7 of these are going to be bad investments. So just continually scour the portfolio. Be unbiased. Don't be affected by how many years ago or months ago you bought the stock. Don't be affected by what you paid for the stock. Just look at the information as if you were launching your fund today. Would you buy this position today? Being unbiased.
Yeah.
If you launched today and if things start to go wrong in that, you're looking for that. You're okay with that. Before you even buy the security, you want to, we call them black sky or shadow models. We'll build a short case in some of our favorite companies with great returns on invested capital, with strong management teams and interesting sectors. There's a lot of opportunity and they're cheap. Well, let's buy those things. Okay, great. Now write a short case on why this might be a great.
So would that be the same analyst or a portfolio manager doing that, or would that be a
absolutely
different team?
Yeah, you want the same person to do it. Some people do it with different people. I got the short guys, I have the long guys. I want the same person to do it because that helps de-bias them. That helps them to see bigger picture and process good news and bad news, and it helps them to confront this confirmation bias issue, which I think is the biggest behavioral trap there is. It's public enemy number one, confirmation bias.
Okay. So confirmation is the hardest bias to beat.
Yeah. Well, you tend to look for information which supports your existing view. We all do.
Yeah.
You don't go out and try to find news which is contradictory to what you believe, especially if you've been public about your view. If you've told your investors, if you've told your boss, hey, this is the greatest idea I've ever had. Look at all this work I've done. The last thing you want to do is go out and find information which makes you look stupid. That's what we should do.
So that's what this theory about being the devil's advocate should then try to find reasons to not be looking for things to agree with you.
That's exactly right. That's where the value added comes from. We cannot. I mean, once we buy a stock, we're all inclined to go out and find more information which supports the view we already had. But we already bought the stock. We already own it. You're just finding more information, creating what's called a representativeness bias, repeating over and over again good news, and you're not paying attention to the information which may be just as valuable, if not more so, because it doesn't confirm with your pre-existing view. So confirmation bias is why we hang on to positions for too long that aren't working. It adds to that disposition effect that with Kahneman and Tversky uncovered when they thought about loss aversion. They ended up winning a Nobel Prize for this prospect theory.
Yeah, we hang on to our losers and we cut our winners way too soon.
Way too soon. Yeah, and using academic speak, they would say that you become risk-seeking in the domain of losses. So in other words, you hang on too long because you're going to wait to sell it until it gets back up, and you become risk-averse in the domain of gains. Oh, hey, I need 12%. I'm going to sell it.
Yeah, I don't want to lose the 12%, no.
Right, I don't want to lose it because it hurts more to lose after you've won.
Exactly. So what are other important biases, in your opinion, amongst professional portfolio managers?
Yeah, well, it's amongst all human beings. But confirmation bias, yes, will be the number one for us. And then behind that, and somewhat related to it, is anchoring, where investors won't update their belief in response to evidence they didn't expect because they've got a pre-existing view. They don't want to change it. And also another similar one, Jens, is called herding, where sell-side analysts or investors will often focus on the exact same information as each other. And they all because they hear it from each other, they tend to think that's the only information that's important. So you you start to notice that the herd is following certain ideas and not paying attention to things which they should be.
Yeah, we'd rather go with the herd than be left behind, standing looking like a fool.
Yeah. Well, there's this old adage in the U.S., and I don't know what the Danish equivalent is, but this is from long ago. There, people say you never get fired for hiring IBM. What it basically means is if you go with a firm that's respected and everyone likes, and it doesn't work out, well, it's okay. You hired the best, or everyone else is invested there too, or used that consultant or whatever. It's not your fault.
Yeah.
And so you tend to follow the herd. That's something to be careful of. We talked about disposition bias. That's another one that people suffer from. And you know this, Jens. Losses hurt more than gains feel good. They hurt about twice as much. There's math behind it. They know this. If you know whatever, however much money you can have no money or tons of money. But once that figure is big enough, so it matters, losing that money feels a lot worse than making it felt good. And so the disposition effect is real.
Yeah.
And those are the big ones. There are three or four other ones which are. There's a lot of other ones that people overdo and try to read into, but those are the big ones for me.
So when you're evaluating a company, do you attend company calls and talk to the management, stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. Talk to the management. We will talk to their competitors.
But talking to the management, a lot of biases come into play there as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know that. I mean, often for us, we have calls with management teams. I'm almost just as interested in learning about what they have to say about the rest of the sector than they do about themselves, because they're a little more objective when they're talking about their peers. They don't necessarily put them down, but they also don't have those same sort of internal biases that might be affecting them. And a lot of it as well, too, Jens, is you get to know them over the years and you see changes in body language or you just watch them, you know, change something they might have said 2 years ago that was very important to them. It's no longer being discussed. Well, that's a change. You look for changes. You look for their comments on the industry. But most of the information we get about companies is from their competitors, from their customers, their suppliers, and just reading stuff and knowing the industry.
So you're mostly talking to management to learn about other companies than the one they're representing, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, we try. I mean, obviously, we all have questions for the company about that company, you know, especially if it's a new management team and trying to understand where they're going. Mm. If we can get some information about other companies, there's a little less bias in that when it comes.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen. Find alle de gamle episoder i din favorit podcast afspiller eller se mere på investeringpohjernen.dk.
So when you in your description of Alpha Europe, which is the fund that you manage, or am I wrong there? Yeah,
that's correct.
You talk about behaviorally affected investment decisions. What does that mean?
Well, we're looking, when we look for things to own, we want to be differentiated from what people could do themselves. We want to have a concentrated portfolio so that the ideas are idiosyncratic in nature. In other words, payoffs, which offer a nice risk reward for you as an investor. And so there's things that we can do to help that along. We tend not to focus on the more macro-driven or the macro-dominated sectors. We have no skill at all at knowing what's going to happen to interest rates tomorrow or to the Danish or British or American stock market tomorrow. I don't know. That's a flip of the coin for me. We don't have a macro view. Some people do. Yeah, that's all you see on TV. Oh, the markets, our target for the S&P this year is this. I have no idea. But I can get an idea at an individual company level that I have a certain level of conviction of them beating earnings by 10 or 20 or 30% in the next 2 or 3 years. And if we can do those things, avoid the more macro groups, avoid the ones where it's more top-down in nature, and try to focus more on differentiated, idiosyncratic, firm-specific ideas, that helps us to do a better job identifying potential areas where there may be some alpha. and we have to stay concentrated. We don't want, I do advocate diversification for many investors, but for us, we don't want to be diversified. We want to be very company specific.
Yes. But what about the behaviorally affected part of it? What does that mean? Do you want to find companies that other people have a bias towards, or?
There's two types of, generally, there's two types of ways to be behaviorally affected. One is that the market is underreacting to changes in the business model, and so the stock price is not yet reflecting what the fundamentals will look like. So that's behaviorally affected through underreaction. The other type is overreaction, where news comes out, vivid news, on the news, everyone's talking about it, and it's bad. Sometimes the stock goes down appropriately, but sometimes people overreact to the bad news. The recent vivid public news gets a lot of attention, particularly in the days of
social media
phenomenon. And so you get these overreaction biases. And so we'll say, hey, this company should be down 3-4% on this news. It's probably, it's still a good business long term, but yeah, they kind of screw things up a little bit. But instead, it's down 22. Like, oh, okay, well, maybe we'll buy some, because this doesn't make any sense. So that's buying an overreaction. Those are the two, that you buy overreactions or you buy underreactions. The underreaction is that's where most of the alpha comes from, where you find the business which you watch the market change its mind over several years and go from thinking it's a low quality business to a medium quality business, or from a medium quality business to a high quality business. And you watch the multiple go up as they beat numbers. So you get the fundamental uplift and you get the behavioral uplift.
But people are not buying into it, so it's not going up with the market, so to speak.
It's not going up as Eugene Fama would expect it to. It's not going up immediately to the price it should reach. It's taking time. And that's, I think, that's one of the biggest reasons why we see momentum in financial prices, because prices don't quickly adjust to where they should go. It takes time for Mr. Market to show their biases.
So you're not trying to measure the biases by other investors or the market in general?
We're trying to, we write up a lot of notes. We'll say, this is where we think the market is suffering. These investors, this is what they're suffering from. You know, in these particular cases, they have a clear confirmation bias. They're not even talking about this business, which is spitting off all this cash, which they're going to pay out as a dividend, because that information doesn't corroborate their pre-existing negative views. The sell-side analysts don't want to focus on it or write about it. And so the stuff they want to not pay attention to, but we know will matter in more than a month or more than 6 months or more than a year or two time horizon, then we can capitalize on that.
Do you think it would be easier if to make investment decisions if you were a psychopath? You probably heard about the study out of Stanford where they...
Well, I do think that in some ways, and I try to do this myself, I suppose that the older I get, the easier it is. I try to forget what happened, like when stocks have gone up a lot or down a lot. I think it's so important to not be affected by the past, particularly like when a new management team comes in, and you might have a view of a company based on many years, literally, of knowing what they do, but things can change. And moreover, you can have periods of extreme volatility. We saw that in 2008, GFC. We saw it during COVID. And you naturally have an internal sort of angst from positions you lost a lot of money on. You don't want to deal with them anymore. We exited that position. I don't want to look at it. But you got to say I'm biased. Every day is a new day. Is this the portfolio you would own today if you started your business today? And try to be a psychopath in that regard, where you're just forgetting everything that happened yesterday.
Yeah, and that's what you're trying to sort of do with the rules that you have to try to look into. What do people think right now, and how do you forget about anchoring and stuff like that? So you try to invent rules.
Yeah, back to this notion that Kahneman taught us that, hey, we're suffering from the same biases we're trying to capitalize on. If we spend a lot of time on our philosophy internally and create a process which is very specific about memorializing our investment views from the beginning, writing short cases for the stocks that we like so we can open ourselves up to disconfirming information, writing compelling short cases, understanding who is on the other side of the trade. We can do those things, then all of a sudden we're de-biasing ourselves. And so the process aspect is the most important thing. And if you make or lose money on an individual name, that's going to, even if you're really good at this, you're going to get 2 out of 3 right. And you get 1 out of 3 wrong. That's if you're very good. But over time, as I look at just individual outcomes, you can look at a lot of different outcomes and start to see if your process is working. The third aspect of that for us is the partners that we manage money for. We want them to be on board with that and understand how we think and what we do. And if they're aligned with what you're doing, then you're less likely to introduce the same biases that the economist's worried about. If you have partners that are, or even teammates that are all buying into this sort of investment approach, then it's much more likely that you can have a culture where it's okay to be wrong. Hold your head up, say, I screwed this up. I thought this would happen, but that happened. Fine, good catch. We only lost 8% on that instead of 22%. Mm. You know, if I talk about some of my favorite books, Charlie Ellis wrote a book called The Loser's Game. In his view, managing money over the long term is as much about avoiding big losers as it is about finding big winners. And I think he's right. And so, again, if you're a great stock picker, you got a 30 of your names, which are going to be big losers if you're running a 20 or 30 stock book.
Yeah.
Which ones are they?
Yeah. And having the disposition effect in mind, I mean, if you have a big loser, that's going to hurt a lot. And you take small winnings. So you really need more than the 2 out of 3 that you have normally to outweigh the big losses.
Well, if you can offset some of those, the disposition effect, and have a culture where it's okay to make mistakes, you end up not having the big losses. Mm. And this is one thing that we've been doing it for a while, that we've been able to make more money in our winners than we lose in our losers. And I obviously, no one's perfect, but broadly, I try not to let the losers bother me. And sometimes I even welcome it if it's a position, especially if it's not a position that's been maxed out yet. That's not to say that you just want to automatically buy more of every stock that goes down, because obviously if it's one of those 1 out of 3 you're getting wrong, you're getting it wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just chasing bad money. So that's art as much as it is science.
Catching a falling knife, that is also called.
That's very, very, I don't recommend it.
No.
At all.
Har du idéer til emner eller gæster, du gerne vil høre mere om, kan du sende en besked fra hjemmesiden investeringpohjernen.dk.
There's something called optimism bias as well, where we know there's a bias, but I'm not touched about it. I mean, I'm not going to be falling for the anchoring. I have thought this through or whatever it is. The talking about it, I can see that can help, because that's a tool that you have. You have an open policy that we have to try to avoid the biases. And by talking about them, that could help it. But isn't it true that the optimism bias can sort of...
Perhaps it could. I've never thought about that as one of these classic behavioral biases. But sure, we all can be optimistic and hopeful.
Yeah.
And I think you just want to try to be as process-oriented as you can. And especially for, like, when I was a young analyst at Fidelity back in the day, and you do, 100 hours of work on a company, and you're pitching it to the portfolio managers, and they buy the stock, and they make it a 5 or 10% position in their fund, and they own 4% of the company. Our natural inclination is to want to go out and find more information which supports our view, make us look smart. Hey, look, I just found out this great thing about the company now, too. Hey, look at this good stuff. You want to find information which makes you look smart, which confirms your view. You don't want to go out and poke holes in your own thesis, but that's exactly what you should do. That's exactly what we all should do. So to the extent that you have partners in your as investors that know that's what your process is, well, I think you're on your way to shedding some of those behavioral biases that Kahneman and Thaler are all worried about.
Yeah, if you have the open mind about it, if you have a company policy to talk about it, if you have the partners.
Have a culture where it's okay to be wrong.
Exactly. And they can ask questions and sort of stand away from the herd in order to, without being looked at as stupid or anything like that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it.
Yeah. I often compare that with bowling. I mean, if you take kids bowling, they will end up in the gutter. But then they have these railings that sort of keep them in the middle. And we need, as investors, we need those railings to sort of stick to the strategy, to hold on and think correctly, even take into mind that we make bad decisions and find out how to work with them.
Yeah, that could be a good analogy, Jens. The one thing I would say is there are some railings you can use, which I will never use. For example, we don't, if you're aware of what a stop loss policy is, right? When I lose 10%, I'm selling this no matter what. I hate those. I call them stop gains. Because you invariably sell the bottom tick and then it rallies back. If the story's changed and you're getting the fundamentals wrong or your buy case has been weakened, sure, sell the position. But don't just sell it because of some random volatility that showed up. Sometimes that can be opportunistic. So to the extent that the guardrails are forcing you out of positions, I don't like that. Mm. I think there's opportunities to not, and a lot of other folks are forced to do that, which means the volatility is exacerbated, which I think can be a great opportunity for investors. Yeah. But yeah, I totally agree broadly. Yeah. Yeah.
So all of us just doing passive investing, are we just stupid fools putting fire into the market and making it difficult to make IPOs because they're not in the index, so nobody can buy them, and removing liquidity from everything but the big equities in the S&P 500 and the Magnificent Seven and the Danish Novo and stuff like that?
No, that's been obviously a great topic of discussion.
It
is. The impact of passive flows on security pricing. It's very topical today, but I would also say, Jens, it's been topical since the mid 80s. People have constantly been asking this question, is the inclusion in an index affecting the pricing of securities? Obviously, when there's an announcement that you're in the index, there's a little bit of a bump, but then it comes back and finds equilibrium typically. But what we've seen in the last 10 years is anything but. And so the big question is today, are we getting to the point where the passive tail is wagging the dog and creating prices? It's hard to answer that. I know some very smart folks that think that it's the only thing that matters. In my view, and this is going to a Benjamin Graham type of view, that the market is a voting machine in the short term. Flows do affect prices. But in the longer term, it's a weighing machine. It's the fundamentals. It's the cash flows. It's the earnings growth. It's the fundamentals that drive the ultimate performance of individual securities. The question, Jens, is how long is that long term? Is it a year? Is it a month? Is it 5 years? How long can prices stay out of whack? And I think there are examples now. And we saw in 2021 with securities like GameStop or AMC in the States, it just went hog wild. That was all flows and nothing to do with fundamentals.
And low liquidity also helps doing the GameStop.
Yeah, that can help when you have a big retail contingent of investors. But earlier you mentioned just, is investing in passive stuff a terrible thing? No, I actually don't think so. I think that if I were giving advice to individual investors, retail investors, say someone's in their mid-20s, it would be to save as much money as you can and put it all in equities. But don't put it into a fund like mine. Put it into a diversified, tax-efficient, indexed ETF. If you're in Denmark, not just in the Danish market or not just in the Nordic market or not just European market, just in some ETF which is indexed around ideas, indexed to equity markets, that's tax-efficient. And once you buy it, don't look at it. Look at it once a year. Don't look at it every day. Just buy it, put it away, let it grow, and don't be affected. Because once you start checking prices every day or every hour, because of the disposition effect, you're going to see some stocks down 5%, some stocks up 5%. Well, you're going to be constantly miserable because those losses hurt more than the gains feel good. Just don't look at your portfolio And if you really just have an inkling to play the game into the individual security land and you think you can compete there, fine, but limit it. 10% of your portfolio. Okay, 10% of my portfolio, I'm going to buy cool stuff that my buddies want to buy and we can talk about. But the 90% of it, just buy it, buy a tax-efficient index and let it do its work over time and things will compound for you, especially if you're younger.
It might be my confirmation bias kicking in, but I really like that that part that you said right here. But that's also why how I think a lot of people should invest. So it might be confirmation bias kicking in. I don't know, but great to hear from a guy with a concentrated active portfolio. That was interesting to hear that coming from you.
I think for individuals who are either deciding to spend money or save it, and if they save it, are they going to put it in a bank or in bonds or something? No, put it in the equity markets if you're 25, yes. 35, and watch things work. If you're an institution and you can get all that beta at a very low price, you should do that. And to the extent that you want to allocate to someone like us, that's to try to get excess returns above the market's returns. But it's very specialized, and it's certain, it fits within a broader portfolio to try to do those things and outperform, because compounding makes a huge difference over the long run. But
yeah,
if you're not a professional, if you're not in that, doing that level of work, developing that level of conviction, just buy an index.
And frankly, most professionals will do that for the vast amount of their portfolio and do the beta for a smaller part of it. Isn't that quite normal?
Yeah. If you look at the more diversified mutual funds, they're mostly overweight or underweight versus a benchmark. And
yes,
they will get all of their excess returns or losses come from the top 20% of those positions. And if they're very good at it, they'll have excess returns and they'll beat the market. But there's a lot of cost that can be associated with that, trading from capital gains and tax inefficiencies. ETFs are a way around that. ETFs are able to sort of be a little bit smarter about. It's very specialized to be that concentrated, and you have to,
Yes.
You're pulling your hair out, working 100-hour weeks, trying to figure these things out. But if you love it, that's fine. But I don't recommend it. Yeah, but if you want to have fun and buy a few stocks that your buddies own and you want to talk about it when you go to the pub, fine. But just don't let it be more than 10% of your, if you're an individual investor, don't let it be more than 10% of what you're saving.
Nope. Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen. Husk at abonnere, så du ikke går glip af et afsnit. Great talking to you, Drew. I just have three more questions to go, and one of them has two answers. And what do you consider your own best and worst investment? Hopefully, I guess it's two different investments. But what was your best investment ever or worst? You decide what to start with.
It'd be more fun, Jens, if I could say it was the same investment. But
exactly.
It is. I mean, actually, they're in the same sector. The best investment we made, which we bought back in 2014, was in what was then Fiat. And it was managed by Sergio Marchionne. He was the CEO. John Elkann and Exor are big shareholders. But Sergio, basically, he was able to see value inside of the business that the market wasn't giving it credit for. And the market hated it, because they thought of it as an old Italian...
Not efficient, not working, yeah.
Inefficient, metal-bashing automaker. And so Sergio said, well, okay, you can think that, but guess what? How about I spin off Ferrari? And how about we create a trucks business, Fiat Industrial, CNHI, out of this division? And how about we spin off Magneti Marelli? And all these things that were sitting inside the group that had great, tremendous value. I did an analysis. The value of Fiat and all of its pieces back in 2004 or 5 or 6 was about 6 billion euros. And he passed away in 2018, I think it was. By then, all of those pieces were worth over 60 billion euros because he'd found ways for the market to see their value. So we were a big beneficiary of that. We were big fans of Fiat, which is now called Stellantis because they merged with Peugeot.
Yeah. But there could be a lot of biases involved in the car business. I mean, either you like it or you don't. We have a lot of opinions about that. And here in Europe, Fiat was not seen as the most efficient car producer.
Right. Well, I mean, the two most efficient car producers in the world. Well, I would say it's Stellantis now with their new boss, Carlos Tavares, is fantastic. And they bought Opel, which was GM Europe, when he was at Peugeot, and now they've merged with Fiat Chrysler, and he's done a wonderful job at making things streamlined and improving margins. But the two big boys are Volkswagen in Germany and Toyota in Japan, and those are the ones that, you know, they have 10 or 12% market share each globally, and they're just huge machines. But no, automaking is not seen as a sexy sector. But in the case of Fiat, which was going from being a company that people hated to one that they loved, while they beat numbers in the process, you get this wonderful effect.
Yeah.
So that was the best stock. The worst stock, Jens, also in the auto sector, and this was a very short period back in 2008, was Volkswagen.
Yes.
Volkswagen has two classes of shares. They have ordinary shares and preference shares. The ordinary shares have voting control. The preference shares don't, but they pay a bigger dividend. Voting shares are held by Porsche SE or over 50%, like 53% of the voting shares, which gives them control of the company. And back 2007 and 8, they were buying up a lot of those shares of Volkswagen, effectively assuring that they would take over complete control. And what it meant is that the ordinary shares were trading they should be about the same price. Maybe
yeah, but
10%
they were
apart. They were 100% apart. And the ordinary shares, the voting shares, were just rocketing to 400 euros a share. And the prefs were trading at 180 or 200. And so a lot of hedge funds, and this is, we were running a long short fund at the time as well, too. A lot of hedge funds were short the ords and long the prefs. It felt like an arbitrage, a free money arbitrage, where eventually these things would collapse and I'll make 100%.
Yeah.
So everyone in the world was short the ords. And we didn't let ourselves do that because, like, oh no, we're going to be differentiated. Everyone's already doing that. We don't find anything novel in us coming in to do the same thing. So we avoided shorting the ords. And we told ourselves when the stock starts to break and things start coming back in, it looks like the coast is clear, then maybe we'll do that. So we did that. Jens, on a Friday in September in 2008, everything we thought was lined up, and we put on a reasonably sized position on that Friday, selling shares of Volkswagen ordinary share stock at 210, 220 euros per share. Happy, we have the short position on filing in Volkswagen in the ords. And that Sunday, Ferdinand Piëch, who was the head of Porsche SE at the time, put out a press release saying that they had bought control, more shares than anybody thought. So much so that they had 60 or 70% of the shares outstanding after they exercised their option. The state of Lower Saxony had 20 or 25% of the time. In other words, there was no float left, and everyone is short the ords. And I can't remember what his language was precisely, but it was really cheeky. He was like, we hope that this disclosure gives you so-called short sellers the opportunity to settle your relevant positions without having to rush. And I was like, oh, crap. And I don't know, Jens, if you know the difference between market orders and limit orders. Market orders, you just put an order in with your broker and say, I want to buy this stock, pay whatever it is.
Whatever price.
Limit order is, okay, I want to pay 210 euros for this to buy it back. Every single trade I've done has been a limit price. I want to pay this. I might change the price. But that Sunday night, I said, oh, my God. And I called up our traders in the morning. And I said, I want you to buy back. We had to put a 5% position on. This was big for us. I want you to buy this whole position back at the market.
No limit.
As soon as you can. No limit. Market on open. I'm a buyer.
And everybody was doing that, probably.
They're going to continue to do it. We'd sold that stock short at 220 euros per share on Friday night. On Monday morning, I paid 350 euros. I mean, literally losing 60 or 70% over a weekend.
Over the weekend, yeah. Expensive weekend.
The stock over the next 2 days climbed to 1,100 euros per share. Volkswagen was the most valuable, highest market cap company in the world during that squeeze. It was 14 times bigger than Amazon at the time. It put a lot of groups out of business in the process. We ended up making money on both the short and long side of Volkswagen over the course of the year, but that was one hell of a day. Markets can be
terrible,
crazy.
Terrible. Yeah, they can.
Du kan lære mere om investorpsykologi i bogen Når hulemænd investerer af Jens Balle. Find den på averagejoe.dk eller i din boghandel.
You had one more question, Jens. What was it?
Yeah, you said you would like to read books non-fictional books. So your best book on investing, you mentioned The Loser's Game.
The Loser's Game by Charlie Ellis is definitely on that list. I love it. I think I loved The Money Game by Adam Smith. And that was a pseudonym. His real name is George Goodman. But it's called The Money Game by Adam Smith. It's probably the best book on investing. And it was written in the 50s or 60s. It's fantastic. I'm also a big fan.
The Money Game by Adam Smith, yeah?
Yep. And I already told you about Winning the Loser's Game by Charlie Ellis. And then the obvious one, which everyone mentions, is Benjamin Graham, An Intelligent Investor. What I like about that, which people don't discuss nearly enough, is to me, Benjamin Graham is the grandfather of behavioral finance.
Yeah.
Benjamin Graham was talking about the psychology of the market long before any of us were. He famously said, I remember uncovering this and committing it to memory. The market is a voting machine whereon countless individuals register their votes, partly the product of reason, partly of emotion. So here's Benjamin Graham, the father of value investing, telling you that the market can be emotional, and it is. So that's a great book too. Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham, Winning the Loser's Game by Charlie Ellis, The Money Game by Adam Smith.
So my last question for you, Drew, before I let you go, is if you could travel back in time, back to the future, and meet yourself, 25-year-old, what kind of, do you have any investment advice to give yourself? You probably this analytics working in Fidelity at this time, or how was it?
Not yet. I was still a commodity trader then.
Oh, commodity trader, yeah?
Yeah. I kind of like what I said earlier, Jens. From an investing perspective, what I would tell myself is save more.
Oh, yeah.
Save as much as you can. Put it in the stock market and don't look at it. And just buy an index of stuff. And obviously, if someone specializing in that, maybe it would have been okay for me, which I eventually did, pick more individual securities. But for most of us, just buy the passive index. And we can have a whole other podcast about the impact of passive flows on security pricing today. But that's a shorter-term topic. That's very relevant, I think, as we talk about the 97 or Tesla or these things that have gone crazy.
Yeah.
But over a 20, 30, 40-year time horizon, just own the market. And don't look at it. Don't look at it. That'll mess you up. You'll be constantly unhappy because losses feel worse than gains feel good. Just don't look at it. Do other things. Play your guitar, shoot some baskets.
But we have the market just in our phone and we can just look at it. And Apple even pre-installed the app on our phones. I know. What kind of help is that?
It's not good, especially for the kids who just... You know, the gamification of a lot of these sites where it looks like you're playing a video game when you're buying and selling GameStop or AMC. So, my advice to other 25-year-olds or to myself back in the day, if I weren't in the business, if you want to have that kind of fun buying things like that, I hope you don't. But if you have to buy stuff, make it 10% of your portfolio. Hey, let's talk about this. I bought this stock. The rest of it is just... buy a tax-efficient ETF, my friend Wes at Alpha Architect sells a bunch of great ones. Go over there and buy stuff.
Yeah.
Don't load up on the latest Reddit-influenced meme stock.
Do you think 25-year-old Drew Dixon would have listened?
Probably not.
We know it all at that time in our lives, don't we?
I knew much more then than I do now. Absolutely.
Drew, it's been great talking to you. And I might take you up on that opening the door where you said we could talk about that in another podcast about passive investing.
I'd love to have another chat, Jens. Yeah, I'd love to have another chat. That one is, that can get technical, but it's fascinating.
It is, yeah. I'd love to get back on that. So thank you for today. I'll leave you to the market. You're about to open the market, I guess, in the U.S.?
Well, I'm focused on Europe, so I've been open since 3 o'clock my time. Actually, 4 o'clock now that we've done daylight savings.
Yeah, for a couple of weeks here, yeah?
Yeah, but U.S. market's opening up at 9:30. Oh, it is open. Sorry, we're open now.
Yeah.
We've been open for 48 minutes. Time flies when you're having fun, Jens.
Thank you for joining me. We'll talk later.
All right, sounds good. Take care.
Du har lyttet til Investering på Hjernen med Jens Belle. Har du idéer til emner eller gæster, du gerne vil høre mere om, kan du sende en mail til info@investeringpohjernen.dk eller sende en besked fra hjemmesiden investeringpohjernen.dk.